Library. I'm Sarah Holliday, Library Events Coordinator, and I'm mostly standing here for two practical purposes, one grand and one trivial. The grand one is to note that your donations to our annual fund support events like this one, as well as the maintenance of our landmark building, and the continued growth and strength of our collections for readers of all ages. It's not too late to give in 2015 and be honored in our next annual report. Donor information is available at the circulation desk or from any staffer. We appreciate your support. My trivial task, I bet you can guess, to ask you to silence your cell phone. See how mine is turned off? Let's all be like me. We're very honored to have with us this evening authors and library members Lily Tuck and Molly Haskell. Molly Haskell is the author most recently of the memoir My Brother, My Sister, and the film study Frankly, My Dear, Gone with the Wind Revisited. You've also doubtless seen her reviews in the New York Times and many other publications. Lily Tuck has written not only The Double Life of Lily Ann, on which we'll concentrate tonight, but The News from Paraguay, winner of the 2004 National Book Award, and four previous novels. Please join me in welcoming Molly Haskell and Lily Tuck.
Of the double life, or was it the film?
Actually, the film
are people like the pastry chef at Maxine's and a convicted murderer. And although he never saw any battle, he claims that that was the time when he became a man. Mark felt he was a man. Meantime, my mother and I were in Paris. I was a woman, so I don't remember anything, obviously. My mother and I and a nanny drove to Lisbon, and we took a ship to New York. Eventually, I mean, it took a while to get visas and everything. Everybody was trying to get out. And we had a visa for New York for 3 days. And my mother remembers going to the World's Fair and being very surprised at how affluent and carefree everybody seemed, obviously compared to people in Europe. And then from there, we went to Lima, Peru, where we stayed for the duration of the war. Then we went back to Paris, and we spent about a year and a half there, and then my parents got separated. And this is where I start reading when we come to America. In the fall of 1947, Liane, who has just turned 8, and her mother leave France. Oh, my mother's name was Irène, which is French for Irene, but she insisted on being called Irène, not Irene. Her mother leave France on a converted troop ship operated by Moore McCormick Lines. There's still a severe shortage of liners. Only 13 are in transatlantic operation versus 73 before the war. And only 2, the Queen Mary and the America, of the 13 are luxury liners. The rest are substandard and provide low-cost transportation. The fares range from $167 to $190 for the women and a flat fee of $127 for the men. The passengers sleep in open troop quarters that hold more than 100 passengers each. The sleeping berths are arranged in tiers of 4. Each berth has a mattress, clean linen, a blanket, a towel, and a cake of soap. Arriving on board late, Irène and Lilian are unable to get berths on the same tier. The women already occupying the seat, others refuse to give up their space or to move. Lilian sleeps on an upper berth a few tiers away from Irène, who sleeps on the lowest berth on another tier. In the berth directly below Lilian, a woman has managed to snuggle in her 2 little dachshunds. The dachshunds whine restlessly during the night and keep Lilian awake. The overhead lights are kept on all day and all night, and they too keep her awake. Irène also can't sleep, and most nights she gets up at 3 or 4 in the morning to use the communal bathroom and to take a shower. At that hour, she has some privacy. Most of the passengers on board are displaced persons. Thus far, only 36,000 out of the near million Eastern European displaced persons have been allowed entry into the United States. 14-year-old Vera, who was sent to a forced labor camp and whose parents were gassed, was one of them. She and Lilian play cards together. They play relentlessly all day, sitting cross-legged up on either Lilian's berth or on Vera's, also a top berth, without ever exchanging a single word. Lilian speaks only French and Spanish, and Vera only Czech, except for when she shouts out, "Va à la pêche, go fish." "Can you stop playing for a bit and go up on deck and get some fresh air?" Lilian has to tell Lilian. "You'll get sick if you stay in the cabin all day," she adds. Also, Irène is not sure she likes for Lilian to spend so much time with Vera. Although not the girl's fault, Irène senses something feral and perverse about her. She imagines that Vera's experience of deprivation and of perhaps beatings and rape in the labor camp will taint Lilian. When Lilian goes up on deck, the air is humid, the ocean is relatively calm, and uniform gray. While she sits in a deck chair and reads her book, Les Malheurs de Sophie, Sophie's Misfortunes, by the Comtesse de Ségur, an account of the trifling misadventures of a little French girl who regularly disobeys her parents and suffers the consequences, a Hungarian boy, his arms flailing, looks to be about 15 or 16, and the Yen knows there's something wrong with him. Each time he runs by the Yen, he shouts something at her, and the Yen, pretending to be absorbed in her book, does not look up. He frightens her. As the Yen shuts her book and gets ready to leave, the Hungarian boy comes around once again, and as if guessing her intention, he stops and stands directly in front of the Yen's chair. Then, before the Yen can move or say anything, the Hungarian boy drops his pants. A heavy-set Polish woman sleeps in the berth directly above your hands, and every night around midnight, a man tiptoes into the room from the men's quarters and climbs into her berth. To do so, he first steps on the edge of your hand's berth before he hoists himself up into the woman's berth. Then the two have sex. Above Yan's head, the berth shakes so violently, she's afraid it will collapse on top of her. After a few minutes, the shaking stops. Then, almost immediately, the man leaves. Again, he steps down on the edge of Yan's berth. One night, a second man comes shortly after the first one has left, and he too steps on the edge of Yan's berth before hoisting himself up into the Polish woman's berth. The voyage takes 8 long days. The ship was disgusting, Yan tells Gabby, her future husband, when finally they land in New York Harbor. A floating flop house, she says. Un bordel, a brothel, she adds in French.
One time she said she was stopped by a policeman because she was going
all have heeded those words and set out decades later to blur the boundaries and genres in a literary treatment of her early life. Maybe Tuck's father was bailed out by Josephine Baker when he was stranded in France. Maybe Tuck did have a medical aunt, Barbara, who was summoned to the White House to look at the blemishes on the First Lady Jackie's face. And maybe Tuck did turn heads and break hearts and fly out to meet a pining boyfriend in Bangkok. After a fashion, we stop questioning how much of what we are reading is memoir and how much of it isn't, and simply surrender to the elegant, limpid prose of this, the most beguiling work of early Tuck's career. So, you wrote the essay on autofiction, and it's a French, it was originally, I mean, as Proust and earlier, it's existed since time, you know, the people have been writing practically.
Right, apparently the word autofiction was coined by somebody called Serge Dubrovsky in 1977 because he wrote a book, and I love this, the title in French is F-I-L-S, Fils or Fi, which means either son or thread, depending on how you pronounce it. And he was sort of a postmodern French writer. But clearly other people have been writing autofiction, Proust, Jean-Jacques Rousseau, Joyce, Wordsworth, and apparently even an 18th century BC Hesiod, Works and Days, is meant to be autofiction. So it really isn't anything that new.
Well, and one of the big influences, as you said, is Sebald, W.D.
Yes,
Sebald.
Yeah,
so talk about that a little bit.
Yeah. I mean, I've always loved Sebald, and I find his, I was looking up things about him, and one of the things he said was that fiction should have sort of a ghost-like presence, which I think means that there's sort of a mystery, or that things aren't explained, or and things sort of remain inconclusive, which he certainly, he certainly wrote that way. And also, I think Sebald gave me permission to digress, and I love going off on tangents and writing about the origin of something, or explaining about the aqueducts in Rome, or something that I think may or may not be relevant.
But they're wonderful dispositions, like on the German economy, very informative. I thought it was really great. But there's no kind of warning that this is coming up. I mean, it's just sort of tucked in with everything else. It's part of the same kind of mood and surprise. And I think that's always, and I don't quite understand. I think we are so much more, it's sort of humbling to know that this thing about how our memories, as we know now, are completely unreliable. We're making things up as we go along. We're all unreliable narrators. And Oliver Sacks wrote a piece on memory recently, saying he was shocked to find, and he uses the word, he didn't say the difference between fact and fiction, but life that's been experienced or things that have been assimilated, in other words, that have been pulled in as part of your memories. And he wrote about two bombing experiences during the war in England, and his brother wrote and said, the first one you did see, the other one you couldn't, and you weren't even born then, and you looked into it, and sure enough, he hadn't been born, but he had written about it so vividly, he remembered all the details as if he'd seen it. And, yeah.
I mean, I think if you write something, you spend more time writing the piece than you actually spend on whatever happened, so the writing becomes more vivid and more real. Actually, I just was looking at, I just came upon this absolutely accidentally today when I was looking through another book, and I found this, and which I cut out, which was this was in the New York Times in the Sunday Review section in 2013 by Andre Aciman, and he talks about how memoirists mold the truth. And he's, and I thought this was really good. I'm not a big fan of Andre Aciman's, but I thought this was really good. Writing the past is never a neutral act. Writing always asks the past to justify itself, to give its reasons, provided we can live with the reasons. What we want is a narrative, not a log, a tale, not a trial. This is why most people write memoirs using the conventions, not of history, but of fiction. It's their revenge against facts that won't get killed. lighting alters, reshuffles, intrudes on everything. The small things, a shifty adverb or an adjective with attitude, or just a trivial little comma is enough to reconfigure the past. And maybe this is why we write. We want a second chance. We want the other version of our life, the one that thrills us, the one that happened to the people we really are, not to those we just happen to be.
That's right. And also, it's sort of analogous to the body of the ghost, and it's almost like the hypothetical life, the life that could have been led, all the alternate lives that, and that's what you can do with the incarnation.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, and it's the process of selection, and how do you, like one thing you said to me that you wanted to do, one of the motivations was your family.
Right. And I feel that I also, when I started out, I'm the last, my maiden name is Thompson, and I'm the last Thompson, you know, alive still. And my children and my grandchildren, they all know much, their family history is much more heavily weighed on their father's side and the father's family, which is much more accessible. They're from Cincinnati. So I wanted to create sort of a document, even if part of it is fictionalized, that was sort of solid for them, and that was like a book that you could put on a shelf.
And created a sort of semi-created a lover for your mother, Claude, who was a real person.
Yeah.
And the handsome Jack, who was the Apollo player.
No, he was a pilot.
Pilot, yeah.
And
you said he was the love of your mother's life.
Yeah.
Like, I just felt so bad because I loved your father. Oops. And I want you to read
equipment and use it. And then I also had a great grandfather who also German from the Rhineland, who came to the United States in 1848. And he went to Mexico and to Texas, where he sold shoddy cotton goods. And he made and lost a huge fortune. And he kept a journal as well, which I have, which my grandmother translated from the German for me. And actually, the journal is quite boring because he just talks a lot about how much all these goods cost and what he sold them for and stuff like that. But he had, I think, two run-ins with Indians, and that was sort of interesting. And for me, the most interesting part and the most sort of wonderful part was that on his way back to Germany in 1861, when his sort of business had come to a close because the Civil War was about to happen and the ports were shut, so he wouldn't be able to go back and forth. But on his way back to Germany, he stopped in Washington, D.C., and it turned out to be Inauguration Day, and he went into the White House and shook Abraham Lincoln's hand. I still have goose pimples talking about it because, I mean, and what did they say to each other? I mean, I sort of invent a little dialogue, but just how wonderful is that?
Yeah.
So then you're in. So, and so anyway, I use that journal and my father's journal, which I'll read a little bit from.
Actually, how did you give it? Did he give it to you?
He wrote it in French and I actually translated it. And he wanted it. He wrote it for his grandchildren, my three sons. And this is when, this part is when he was in the interned in the camp in France. And it was in a town called Mahol, which is very close to Blois, in the Loire Valley. And before that, he'd been interned in the Stade de Colombe, which was for 15 days, which is where the 1924 Olympic Games were, and that sounded just absolutely horrible because there was no sanitation and there were just hundreds and hundreds of people who were just stuck there for 15 days and they were all on the bleachers and not allowed to move or anything. But anyway, here he is in Mahol. I awoke feeling quite gloomy. I told myself that if they'd forgotten about us at Cologne, here we were even farther away. The refugees were only a small problem for the French government, or perhaps not even a problem. And to have brought us so far must seem that we would stay here a long time, maybe for the entire duration of the war. My gloomy thoughts were interrupted by a young man who came up to me and asked, "Would you like two fried eggs for your breakfast?" I thought he was pulling my leg, and I answered him in kind, "Sure, with pleasure." 10 minutes later, I got those eggs. Simon Herbst, a little Pole who had nothing to do with the Germans except that his papers, due to a bureaucratic mix-up, said German national, was an egg merchant in Paris, as well as the most resourceful person I met during the entire war. Already, he knew everything there was to know about the village of Mahol, and he was always in a good mood and ready to help. bus via the back door, because that's how he got on buses in Paris.
Hmm.
And the bus driver stopped the bus, got out of the bus, yelled at us, and made us get off the bus screaming, you know, something about damn foreigners. So, I mean, that.
How did your mother handle this? Did she try to?
I don't think she was that aware of it.
Uh-huh.
Again, she was so beautiful.
Yeah. When you say that when the boat docks, you bring people and you observe your own rule of chronology, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's one of the, I think, exciting things about it. You go back and forth in time, so that, I mean, I think the whole, that idea of the instability is in the form, in a way, in the non-transition. But when does actually Gabby come in real chronology?
They married in 1949.
Siebel's writing style reflected in your writing?
I think so, yeah, I hope so.
And the pictures?
Yes.
I love this, I said, so I was looking at these, and because, well, my favorite one is the one on the back, which is so grumpy looking.
This was my passport picture when I came to the United States, yeah, did not look happy.
And so sort of overnight, you sort of indicate this, that you overnight sort of, because you were sort of like, you know, adolescence came, and you suddenly slimmed down, and I thought, this is a picture. And I said, who is that? I thought it was one of the movie, one of the stars in one of your father's films, it's like this pinup, and that's her, from this to that.
And to this now, yeah.
Yes.
How were you able to find all the documents about your family?
I have some British relatives who very kindly sent me a lot of stuff, And I also feel slightly guilty because I have a first cousin, the daughter of my mother's sister who lived in Tanzania. And I don't know her very well. Her name is Irene. And I wrote her and said, can you send me any sort of facts or things that you remember about your life in Tanzania with your parents? I'm writing a family history. And so she very kindly sent me things. And it wasn't particularly interesting, except for one item where she said her mother was having breakfast on their terrace in the plantation, the size of a plantation, and she was sitting on a cushion, and under the cushion was a nest of cobra eggs. So of course I used that because I'm sort of a magpie, and I love those kind of details. But then I sent her the book, and then I was very nervous because I made up stuff about her parents and everything, and I thought she will be horribly offended. But instead, just 2 or 3 days ago, she wrote a very nice email saying that she enjoyed reading the book and that she also learned a lot about the family. And so that was.
And she said she didn't care if it was that good.
Right. So that was very nice. Yeah.
Where does the book end? I mean, you said it began with the first book you wrote.
Yes.
What's the shape from the beginning and the end?
Yeah. I mean, it ends with another voyage. I go, the mother goes to Thailand.
When you're in Paul Devine's class at Harvard, that's kind of the age you are.
And then
you quote him about Bruce.
And then I take another plane and go to Thailand, which I in fact did.
And you were how old?
Well, then I was 22, 21.
But you are an adventurer. And when you're not, passage about your mother just getting in the car and driving to Spain. I mean, that's just you. I mean, you get in the car and drive to Maine, you don't know, or
anything.
No, but it's not. Not Maine, but I mean, other places too. You are an adventurer. You are. Thailand. That was a pretty bold thing to do. To meet this guy, you didn't know what was going to happen. Nancy?
I think it's an absolutely wonderful book, but I have reflects my life as a journalist, and I'm sure it plays into your approach to this writing, which is not to have captions on the pictures. I insist on having picture captions, and most of the pictures in the book you could figure out pretty much, but a few of them I really would like to have had identities, but I know this doesn't play into the whole idea of
too much yelling out. I feel the same way, though. I
want
to know, too. I mean, like, Claude is in there, and
I
don't.
Which one is Claude?
Yeah,
yeah.
Well, you
told
me, but I didn't know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know, I just wanted that
mystery.
Yeah.
And Siebel
didn't.
Yes, I knew you were going to say that.
He was following in the footsteps. Him and Nausgaard both give you credentials for
to you? Did you just, it seems incredibly sure, you know, the tone, the shape, everything about it. I mean, I really am so impressed and so full of admiration.
Thank you. You too.
I think structurally it's just amazing. I think you're a very great literary technician in addition to
everything. I didn't pay that much attention to the structure. I mean, I moved some chapters around at some point, but they said
a few things, like you had a lot of information about airplanes at one time.
I did.
Yeah. I thought you knew too much about airplanes at the time. But it was very technical. But you love doing research, right? Like you had your character, a physicist, in your last book.
Yeah.
And you had something that, do you remember anything? Can you tell us what you learned about physics?
Technicalities. I think it's incredibly, it has a wonderful sort of seductive thread running through it. And I think the way that you, because apart from everything else, it's about the sexual awakening of the young girl, which is, I think you just do so beautifully, you know, the strangeness and the mystery of these things that happen to her and her curiosity. In all of that, she's very French as well. She's surrounded
it's by sort of non-judgmental too.
And yes,
yeah.
But it has a wonderful. There's many things, but it has this rather sort of savoir-faire sort of atmosphere that I found very, very intriguing. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Do you think there's any parallel between combining fact and fantasy and autofiction and unconscious plagiarism, which is something I have to guard against all the time?
Mm. Well, that's what Sachs talks about in that same essay. He talks about autoplagiarism. That's and he uses that term. I don't know if he coined it or what, but yes, he says he doesn't know whether it's an unconscious thing, whether he just forgot that he said something before or what. But I think that is very, don't you think that's a very real?
Yeah, I mean, I use things that I've written before in this, and I was very nervous that somebody would sort of.
Did you rewrite them?
I rewrote some, but not everything.
Because you did a short story about the grandfather.
Right.
Yeah.
I used that, and then I read about Alberto Moravia, and I wrote a story. I used that in the Elsa Morante book. So I vocalized myself. and I was worried that somebody would call me on that, but since it's my work,
well, that would be sort of flattering if they remembered it. I think that would be so bad.
but I think I was careful to sort of acknowledge the material that I used. I hope.
I'm just curious then if your children are excited.
My children, they're not. Well, my eldest son is a screenwriter.
The title, The Double Life, you know, suggests that there was an acting out of two different personas, but I found a sort of constant Lily on, sort of, who was able to navigate the two cultures very, very, very sort of stably, in a way.
Mm-hmm.
And I was curious because of the question that was asked before, when did the double life aspect of this sort of finish for you, where you would end up being one rather than the other, and not necessarily at the age of 22, presumably. Incomprehensible.
But I think in the Paul DeMann class that I took, he makes a difference between the writing